Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
All right. Folks, thanks for dropping along tonight, where Lindsay Tanner makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He's been here on a couple of occasions previously. The Honourable Lindsay Tanner was the Member for Finance and Deregulation in the Rudd-Gillard governments, as he then was, and held the seat of Melbourne for the Australian Labor Party from 1993 to 2010. Having retired from politics at the 2010 federal election, he is now a special advisor to Lazard Australia. He is on the board of Suncorp, a vice-chancellor's fellow and an adjunct professor at Victoria University in Melbourne, and most importantly, president of the Essendon Football Club. Now, Mr. Tanner is author of several other books, including Politics with Purpose and Sideshow, and this current book, Comeback, which is the sequel to Comfort Zone. So Lindsay Tanner's here tonight on the occasion of the publication of Comeback. And tonight, because we thought, we wondered what sort of topic we could give this, we agreed on something that everyone would understand, a critical analysis of what's wrong with Fitzroy North. Mr. Tanner, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much, Jared. Thank you very much, everybody, for having me here. Jared, of course, has just revealed something very important, that he suggests the title of What's Wrong with Fitzroy North. Nobody in Melbourne's got any idea where Fitzroy North is. Everybody knows it's North Fitzroy. So Jared has revealed why he has been put in charge of the Sydney Institute. But, of course, he may well come back at me and make the point that it's interesting that I'm making a speech criticising North Fitzroy in Sydney. You'll be pleased to know I'll be making a similar speech in Melbourne next week entitled What's Wrong with Balmain? Hopefully I don't cop too much flack for coming north of the border. And, you know, it's a bit like, you know, you're not supposed to criticise Australia when you're visiting New York or London as an Australian politician. The broad theme of my book, which is essentially a bit of a light adventure crime novel with liberal lashings of satire and a little bit of farce in it, the broad serious theme is ultimately about housing. Now, that can be a real showstopper of a discussion point at any dinner party, housing. It's the kind of thing that often, even in political debates, people tend to want to move on to the next subject. But what it really is focused on is precarious housing, homelessness, and the fact that as well as those who are actually homeless, there is a large population of people in our society who live in a precarious housing situation. And surprisingly enough, there are still very large numbers of them, certainly in the inner city of Melbourne, and I suspect probably in significant parts of inner city Sydney as well. We've all become very accustomed to equating the inner city of particularly Melbourne as synonymous with the cafe latte set, Bernard Salt's famous goat's cheese curtain, all of the indicators of the well-heeled professionals who vote green and eat kale and smashed avocado and all of those other amusing cliches, and tend to be very moralising in their political outlook and take great joy in voting for the Greens. And like all good stereotypes, there are some elements of truth in that stereotype. But part of the point of this second novel, which is a sequel, so my main character, my grumpy late middle-aged taxi driver who's a little bit bigoted, a little bit old world, a little bit politically incorrect, is still the main character. The core underlying theme for this is that there is another inner city that we tend to overlook, and it was very much my core business as a politician, and it's still there, and it's got a lot of challenges and a lot of problems. I do have a secondary character in the novel who is a slightly unfair caricature of that inner city cafe latte set kind of group. Her name's Angela Wright. She runs a local residence group called Residence Action North Carlton, or RANK. totally accidental acronym, but it just seemed to flow off the tongue. And she, of course, is somewhat snobbish, is committed to achieving heritage listing for the entirety of the suburb of Carlton, which, of course, has got nothing to do with the prospective property value implication that that may hold. And she wants to move closer to her son's expensive private school because the traffic in the suburb has got out of control. Now, she's a slightly unfair caricature, I admit, but she's an illustration of a bit of a reality that has crept into the political dynamic in that world. Since the mid-1970s, when I turned up from East Gippsland to go to university, there have been unbelievable socioeconomic changes in the inner city of Melbourne. Again, quite similar changes have occurred in Sydney. And those changes have seen a huge shift in the demographic profile of those areas. The thing that I'm particularly worried about, and part of the theme of this novel, is that increasingly the professional couples, younger to middle-aged professionals, often in public sector employment or the caring professions, who have become more and more prominent as a key demographic in that area, are becoming separated from the wider ordinary working people of this country. And the potentially hugely positive contribution that this demographic could make to Australian society in a political sense, in line with the very positive contribution that they have made in the past, I think is being seriously undermined by this increasing separation from the ordinary world of most Australians. I'm particularly concerned at the tendency for this group of people to drift into what I see as unthinking hypocrisy or distance from the issues that actually they profess to be concerned about, but in many cases are on their back doorstep without them realising. In the 1970s, the area that I moved into, and I have lived in variously, Brunswick, Clifton Hill, North Fitzroy, North Melbourne, Carlton, North Carlton, so I've lived in most of these areas at various times. In the 1970s, this was dominated by Greek and Italian migrants from the 50s and 60s. Still a significant traditional older working class population, and plenty of students, some academics, some professionals. So it's quite a diverse area. And in terms of its political behaviour, not wildly different from surrounding areas. So there were some differences, but broadly speaking, local politics was fairly similar. My seat, when I became the member in 1993, was not at that point seen as dramatically different from neighbouring seats like Gellibrand, Wills and so forth, which had similar big Labor margins. And in the 80s and 90s, that demographic mix, and particular the educated, the university educated people who came to prominence in that area, played a hugely important role in the resurgence of the Labor Party. And when you look back, you can see a whole range of key individuals who ended up in major positions or having a big influence on the very successful era that Labor had in the 80s and 90s as a result of their emergence from that background. So we had, for example, the Gold Street Gang, as they were known, a pragmatic left group that was based around Bob Hogg and Caroline Hogg, also Henry Shapiro and Solon Shapiro. Bob Hogg, of course, went on to be state and national secretary of the Labor Party. Caroline Hogg was education minister under John Kane. And then a whole plethora of key figures, such as Eddie and Jenny Beecham, Andrew McCutcheon, Barry Pullen, Dimitri Dolis, Peter Batchelor, Graham Russell, Brian Howe, Candy Broad, Julia Gillard, all of whom went on to be really major players over an extended period of time. So in that list I've just rattled through, there are a couple of state secretaries, there are numerous ministers, numerous mayors, a prime minister, a deputy leader of the Victorian Labor Party and so forth. This group also was probably the first group in the Victorian Labor Party at least, to produce not just one or two, but a range of leading female figures from a time when the Labor Party was just starting to emerge from its origins as an almost exclusively male outfit. It had a significant informal link with people who'd previously been senior in the Communist Party, such as Bernie Taft, who lived in the area, former National Secretary and long-standing key figure. And overwhelmingly, it was from a professional university-educated background. Parallel to that group, who were in, shall we say, the more moderate end of the spectrum of the left of the Labor Party at the time, there was a more radical group also emerged who didn't produce the same number of senior office holders, but still was very influential and important over that period, including Franz Timmermann, sadly passed away a few years ago, Leslie Podesta, Neil Cole, Ros Eason, Lee Hubbard, who went on to be Secretary of the Trades Hall Council. And this group was slightly more radical leftish, a bit more oppositionist, but still a very significant influential player in internal Labor debates, and along with the first group I mentioned, a major point of connection with a much wider hinterland. Now, people in this group, either group, were not always right on issues. No doubt there'd be many in the room who would disagree with them furiously on many things. Sometimes I disagreed with some of them on many things. But the point is, though, that they were into a mainstream, wider political party which was still very much grounded in working class trade unions, and therefore their expertise, their idealism and their capability was grounded in a wider social context, which meant that you had, I think, a great creative tension that was a critical part of the success of the Hawke and Keating governments, and indeed the Kaine government until it started to go off the rails towards the end. And that wider network of people was also deeply embedded in local communities. So when I went to the North Carlton branch of the ALP in the early days as a Member of Parliament, I knew that anything of significance that was going on locally, even quite minor things, I would find out about at that branch, because there would be people there who were directly involved and interested in it. So these were people also deeply committed to involvement in their communities. And that synergistic impact was something that I don't think any of us really understood at the time, but was very, very important, because it meant that you had a marriage of bread and butter concerns that inevitably trade unions are dominated by. As a former trade union secretary, I know that only too well. But at the same time, you had an infusion of wider picture thinking, idealism, in some cases slightly left field thoughts, that ultimately provided a very good fusion for a progressive political force. Now, if you scroll forward, of course, all of this began to change around the turn of the century. And I want to just work through some of the manifestations of those changes and ultimately where they have taken the inner city of Melbourne and progressive politics too. The first Green councillor was elected to the Fitzroy Council, the first Green councillor, to my knowledge, in Victoria, in a by-election in 2001, not far short of the Tampa federal election. And the key issue in that election, which was a Labor-dominated council at the time, was the issue of parking near the iconic local supermarket, Peter Monty's. And the council was proposing to put in parking meters, which of course was a, you know, traffic reduction, giving people a disincentive to use their cars, maybe walk, all those kind of things, all of the sorts of worthy things that we tend to sign up to when we're not the ones being expected to walk. Interestingly, the Greens ran hard against that proposal, and that helped them win the by-election. So a proposition that was designed to reduce car use, and therefore one would have thought in line with their broad core beliefs, was not seen as appropriate, and the end result was Labor lost the by-election and the council caved in on the proposition not that long thereafter. Now, it's a while since I've checked out around Peter Monty's, but I suspect there probably still are no parking meters outside Peter Monty's. The council has been, if not green-controlled, it's been heavily green-dominated or influenced for most of the recent years. And, of course, subsequently, in the Tampa election in 2001, I ended up in a position where I retained my seat with a margin of around 4-4.5% against the Greens, because there was a more than doubling of their primary vote. And the thing that struck me, I had an interesting experience where I went to the North Fitzroy, or Fitzroy North branch, of the Labor Party shortly after the election to do a post-mortem, and I said, look, one of the interesting things about the defection of Labor voters to the Greens was that when I was out door-knocking, I did a lot of door-knocking throughout my time in Parliament, the loudest and angriest voices about the Tampa issue seemed to come from the people in the best houses in the street. And immediately a couple of people at the branch meeting sort of put their heads in their hands like this as a tacit acknowledgement of that reality. So even then you could see that it was the better-off educated professionals who were starting to drift towards the Greens. And typically the more middle-aged and what I then called the Whitlam generation of my age group, who were starting to drift to voting for the Greens. For some time the Greens have been getting 5 or 6%. In my electorate, that was typically built on university students and some proportion of what you might call alternative lifestyle people, and inevitably the odd protest vote and so forth. But the addition of that older, established, often working in the public sector or in caring professions, professional group, transformed the Greens into a serious threat. And of course, by 2010... they had won the seat after I retired, and they now get an astonishing 43% of the vote in the federal seat. So although I suspect that may retreat a bit in the forthcoming election, they have taken a completely dominant position. The interesting thing is that in 2004, after the 2004 election, where I clawed back a bit of ground, the Greens did a detailed 100-page analysis of their campaign in the seat of Melbourne, because they had obvious ambitions to, if not defeat me, at least to come close, and they actually went backwards. And they made some very revealing statements in this post-mortem where they said that defeating the Howard government was not a strategic priority for the Greens, and that their primary focus was taking votes from Labor. So that was a very honest and transparent moment in a document that was, I suspect, not intended to end up at places like my office. It does reveal the underlying dynamics. The interesting thing about the occupational spread of people in those older groups who've switched to voting Green is that it's totally characterised by university education. So if you want to work out what a likely Green vote is in any area, find out how many people are either tertiary educated or in tertiary education. But it's not universally spread across the spectrum of tertiary education. So that the way I had of analysing it was to look at a rough ratio in a career between job satisfaction and making money. And so the more a particular career was likely to have a significant component of purpose for the individual pursuing it of job satisfaction, and as long as you got reasonably paid and were reasonably comfortable, making millions was not the name of the game, the more likely that cohort of the university educated would be to vote Green. Now that, of course, is the proportion of the total population that's growing dramatically and has been growing for some time. People in those public sector or caring professions typically secure kinds of jobs, but also including many lawyers, many health professionals, a very large proportion of educators and researchers. So it's a cohort that you would hope is making a very, very big contribution to the public discourse of our society, because it's got a lot of expertise, a lot of potential to really be addressing big issues, and something that I think is very, very important for the wider future of our society. It's not a coincidence that there are two big traditional prestigious universities in my old electorate, Melbourne University and RMIT. It's not a coincidence that the proportion of people in the education profession, whether it's teachers, academics or whatever, in the electorate is way, way higher than the typical electorate in Australia. So that is kind of the profile of what has happened. Now, to return to my book, part of the underlying message here is that there is a very disturbing aspect to this phenomenon which I found increasingly sad and irritating as a Member of Parliament, that this group of people tended, with some honourable exceptions, I would agree, tended to be very vocal and often quite moralising on, shall we say, wider abstract issues of human rights, and largely oblivious to the fact that they were living walking distance away from some of the poorest and most disadvantaged groups of people in our society, particularly people living in the high-rise public housing, who included, amongst other things, many refugees, many people who were, had come to Australia on the humanitarian section of the immigration program, many homeless people, and a large and, to a fair extent, hidden cohort of people living in crumbling, pretty ordinary 1960s private blocks of flats. They were scattered around inner Melbourne. I'm sure there are similar in Sydney. Pretty ordinary old-style blocks of flats, and my taxi driver in Comeback and Comfort Zone lives in one of those flats. And there are still lots of people living in those kind of things who are in poor, precarious circumstances, and they're largely invisible. So I was increasingly disturbed that the group of people who in the 80s and 90s would have been connected to the concerns, the issues, and advancing the causes of those groups had, in a sense, through the vanity echo chamber of the Greens, become increasingly isolated from those groups and their concerns. And the classic manifestation of it is in the primary schools, in the electorate. You can go from suburb to suburb and you will see two schools that are walking distance apart, one that is very poor, that is essentially based on the kids of the high-rise flats, and one that is essentially for the kids of the upper-middle-class professionals. And it's all achieved by self-sorting, and there are logical, understandable reasons why this happens, but it's a very disturbing kind of thing when viewed at an abstract, big-picture level. So, to conclude this commentary, and what I've really walked through this evening is essentially the part of the underpinning serious thread to a novel which is broadly meant to be light entertainment with a slight serious tone tucked in there as well. Why does all this matter? What's significant about it? Now, it matters to me a great deal, not just because of the emotional commitment I have to my old electorate and to some of the issues and causes and concerns that do reflect that demographic, and let me say, I still broadly align in terms of sentiment, whether it's on asylum seekers or climate change, where I broadly align with the sentiment of this group. But I would like to see it grounded more in some serious reality. One of the things that shocked me was the number of people, the highly educated professionals voting for the Greens in 2001 who were convinced that if Kim Beazley took a really hardline stance in support of refugees and against John Howard, Labor would win the election. And I knew the reality. I was happy to push back against that myself because of my own personal view of the world. I knew the reality that the opposite was the case and that the people in my electorate were actually quite a distinct minority view in the wider Australian community, rightly or wrongly. I was astonished that they were not aware of that. And it taught me that there was a significant isolation and disconnection from the wider world of the ordinary citizen, ordinary working people across the country. Why this matters to me is that the progressive forces in our society, which I suspect not everybody in the room will necessarily be signed up to, but I certainly am, when they fragment and when they turn on each other, they will both deteriorate in the quality of the output that they produce in a political and social sense, and they will both ultimately wither. And so I feel very strongly that the creative tension that did manifest itself within the Labor Party and the wider trade union movement in the 80s and into the 90s, that was generated by these different forces with different concerns being forced to cohabit and to engage in trade-offs about what mattered, produced basically pretty good governments and some very important developments in our society. Similar things in a slightly different context happened in the Whitlam era, where there was an underlying tension on these things. And in some respects, I see the potential medium-term impact of this, not just on the Labor Party, but on the broader agenda of progressive change, social change in our society, as being fairly similar to the impact of the DLP split in the 1950s in the Labor Party, where even though long-term opponents of that political tendency who fought them bitterly in the trade union movement like me would acknowledge that they were a legit, and the constituency was a legitimate part of a coalition of forces that made up the Labor Party and the Labor movement at that time, and that when you separated those parts, both sides suffered quite badly, and the overall agenda of achieving negotiated, agreed outcomes for the betterment of ordinary working people and the betterment of the quality of our Australian society was actually damaged by that split. So I worry that we are seeing a similar kind of phenomenon starting to develop. And I also worry that people who I would like to think could really make a big contribution to tackling some of the key issues, like why is it that big sections of the workforce are suffering wage stagnation, loss of relevance? Why do we have such widespread alienation of the less skilled, the less educated, who could really make a big contribution to tackling those kind of issues, are actually being quarantined into a much narrower set of concerns. And meanwhile, some of the big issues facing our country are not being addressed as urgently or as seriously as they could be. That coalition of forces that I think was a critical underpinning to the whole Whitlam, Hawke, Keating era, can it be put back together? Possibly not. I don't know. But I think it's something that I would like to think that all people who do subscribe to the idea of trying to harness progressive change forces and win majority community support and acceptance for them, which of course is the luxury the Greens have of not having to worry about, and in fact trade off the Labor Party's responsibility for achieving that as a way of distinguishing themselves, I would like to think that those forces are capable of coming back together again in a way where everybody understands that they're not going to get all their own way all of the time, and that will produce positive change for the future of our country. Thank you very much.
And many thanks to Lindsay Turner. Amy down the back there's got some copies of Come Back, and I'm sure our speaker would be happy to sign any after we finish here, which will be no doubt in the top of the hour, maybe a bit earlier. So we'll come to question discussion. Look, I have a real never to take on speakers at the Sydney Institute, and
but I can hear a but.
I was born in Melbourne, and neither in East Gippsland or Gippsland East. But my colleagues at the ABC, to whom I always go for knowledge about the inner city of Melbourne or Sydney, they tell me it's Fitzroy North.
Well, I always said the ABC was a Sydney-centric institution. Now I know.
These are my colleagues of the ABC in Melbourne, including the executive producer of Four Corners of Insiders. He told me it's Fitzroy North.
They're following orders, obviously.
Coming back to your book and your very interesting analysis tonight, as you know, you looked at Melbourne, you looked at essentially a university city, that part of Melbourne you're talking about, and you're talking about people who are voting Greens with highly educated, but mainly in the social sciences and related professions. In his quarterly essay on One Nation, David Marr looks at the supporters of One Nation, who you'll be aware of this, who he says are not poor, they're not wealthy, but they're certainly not poor. And what distinguishes them, according to David Marr, is that very few of them have university education. They have year 12 or sometimes less than year 12. So what you seem to be looking at with that group, say, in Melbourne, and this other group which is strongest in outside of Brisbane in parts of Queensland, is two diametrically opposed groups.
Yes.
Are they ever likely to meet up?
That's a very good question, and it does ultimately illustrate a key point here, and that is that across the Western world, education level is emerging as the new core political divide throughout the political framework. And one of the reasons you're seeing such chaotic turbulence and incoherence in the political system is that the traditional major forces, which are based on labour and capital income levels and whatever, are actually bitterly divided internally by that emerging dominant fault line. And there's a whole separate discussion that we could have about how that is playing out across the Western world, but it's definitely what is happening. The One Nation and Greens phenomena, of course, are the, shall we say, the extreme ends of that phenomena, but there is no question that they do represent the hard edge of that structural shift, which is turbocharged by the change in the pattern of work and the nature of employment and the rewards. So I did a brief piece for clients at Lazard recently where, to illustrate the problems the Liberal Party has got, I did two little vignettes of mythical individuals, and I said Jacinta is a corporate lawyer living in Mossman who is married to an investment banker. Their household income per annum is roughly about $2 million. She's very concerned about climate change, is pro-asylum seeker, pro-free market, and in her 30s. Dave is a fencing contractor in North Queensland, runs his own business, but that's basically him. Left school before year 12, and in a reasonable year makes $60,000 a year. Both of them are ostensibly Liberal voters. Now, when you and Dave is nationalistic, he thinks we should make more things in Australia. He is socially conservative, and you get the picture. And the problem the Liberal Party's got, and the Labor Party's had equivalent sort of challenges, is that most of the big issues of the day and for the foreseeable future divide those two people. So it's hardly surprising that they're sort of peeling off. How this plays out in practice in our political system, or indeed in the rest of the world, is very, very difficult to predict, because it is heavily shaped by the nature of the political system and the electoral system. So the nature of our system will have a big influence on it, but that dynamic is unstoppable. It's becoming more and more powerful. So Jared makes a valid point. You are unlikely to see the hard edges of that spectrum ever come back together, and maybe we don't want to see that.
Ian.
Is part of the picture that the latte-drinking educated dreamer that you're referring to, one of the reasons that he or she does not do practical things to sort of help the Australian working class is they actually don't like the Australian working class?
I'd like to be fair and say no, but I think one of the things that has disturbed me, I actually wrote a newspaper column about this shortly before I became finance minister, which is the emergence into popular usage of the word bogan, which is basically code for looking down your nose at the strange habits and behaviours of working class people. And so I think you can see, not just with that cohort, but I think you can see a wider cultural snobbery that is afoot in our community. So I suspect probably the correct answer, Ian, is that there are individuals and sections of that group that you could probably say that's a fair comment, but I'd say not the majority. My concern is more just distance, that there is almost a lack of empathy and a lack of concern, because they actually don't bump into them. And where they do, like, I always judge people on things like, well, you know, you work in a building, do you ever talk to the cleaner? You know, and most high paid people working in these high rise towers, the answer will be no. The answer will be no. So they're often in circumstances where they're not mixing with them, whereas in the 70s and 80s and so on, those inner city areas were a very eclectic mix of different kinds of people, and it was hard to avoid being sort of connected with, for example, older Greek people who had really come from very tough circumstances and known what it's like to struggle. I had a great wake-up moment on this years ago as a minister when I met an old Greek bloke in Adelaide, and he was talking about how he'd migrated to Australia in the late 40s, and I asked him, how did you come to migrate to Australia? And he just casually said, oh, my mother and my sister died of starvation. And I kind of went, and the ground dropped from underneath me, and that was a bit of a conversation stopper. But it really brought home to me that we, you know, then and now, we have lots of people in our community who have experienced, and in some cases continue to experience, extreme hardship and extreme challenge. And if you're insulated in a world where you rarely deal with those people as friends or in work-related circumstances or family, well, you kind of don't know.
Dimitri.
Thank you, Mr. Tanner. Your vignette about Dave and Jacinta, is that not just a demonstration of the failure of Australian Federation with the increasing resources and responsibilities moving to Canberra, trying to implement what are by default standardised solutions to areas which were once had their issues dealt with locally?
Look, I think this is a very interesting question. Those of you who can be bothered looking at my inaugural speech in Parliament 1993 will note that I called for the abolition of the states. But I think the realities of the world have moved on in a way where one of the interesting things that's happened is that I'd say for probably the past 10 years, the relative importance of the two levels of government has been shifting back towards state governments. And this is something that has kind of taken me by surprise. Not necessarily the powers, and so it's not to disagree with your point, it's more to say that state governments are actually becoming more important in relative terms, because most of the loss of economic power that globalisation and technology have imposed on governments of Western countries has been felt at the national level. As I'm sure Ian would recall, when I learned economics at school, we were taught that the federal government had four levers to pretty much determine how the Australian economy was going. That was fiscal policy, monetary policy, trade policy and wages policy. And the reality is there's not much left in any of them. That's the reality. But the areas where governments still have a big impact on how our economy and how our lives work are transport, other infrastructure, water, electricity, education and school and hospital infrastructure, and law and order, all the things that state governments dominate. So in relative terms, I think state governments are becoming more important. There's a whole separate debate, I think, about these issues. I wouldn't say that there's a causal link between the distribution of powers and that extreme illustration I've provided, but it's a legitimate question that deserves to be thought through in its own right. Part of the problem with our infrastructure provision, which I sense we're starting to get over, is the mismatch of responsibilities and control of money and powers of the levels of government. So I think there's still a very big set of issues there.
Yes, I was wondering about the role of the Essington Club. I mean, does it have an appeal to people with tertiary education, the caring profession?
Well, one of the interesting things which I think has kind of, to me, reinforced my perspective on all these things is that the perspective that we received from the membership of the Essendon Football Club about our supplements challenges and all of the controversy and drama that we went through for several years that thankfully we've finally got through. I could tell you, if I heard somebody express a view, I could tell you their education level. So that for the higher educated, university educated professionals, they were outraged. How could the club do this? Various people should be shot on tearing up my membership ticket. For the working people, three-quarters of the membership, the attitude was, this is a giant conspiracy by the AFL, we've done nothing wrong, or something along those lines. Now, again, this is a very simplified version, but there was a noticeable difference in the way people saw the world and saw the issues. And so it's something I think we do not take account of enough. And it really hit me in my latter period as a minister that I was part of a Labor cabinet. The erstwhile representatives in the political sphere of the less educated, the less well-off, the working class, all 20 of our cabinet were university educated. All 20. Now, to me, that mattered. And it is something that we are sort of oblivious to, and So it's something I think those of us who are in leadership positions from that background need to take stock of and have a good hard look at themselves and say, hey, the fact that we've had the privilege of that education and opportunities means that there's a range of differences in the way we see the world, and we've got to be conscious of that.
If you're over there and you want to put a question, you've got to put your hand up, otherwise people can't see. Yes?
Yes. For several generations, the overwhelming bulk of the left was willing to join and vote for the Labour Party, even though it was not defined as a left party, it was defined as a trade union party. Now, in the past 20, 25 years, this is no longer the case. The left is no longer willing to vote and join the Labour Party. You implicitly acknowledge that huge change, but why has there been this change?
Yeah, no, look, it's... I think, in a sense, it's difficult for me to answer because, obviously, I haven't been part of the exodus. But I think part of the problem has been the phenomenon I've talked about tonight, which is that growing isolation, which is really a product of numbers. So that if you go back to the 1970s, the proportion of the population who would have fitted that, you know, as Jared described it, that social sciences connected educated class was relatively small. And so it didn't really have the option of signing up to a separate political force that could have at least significant influence, if not power. It has grown to a size where that's become an option. And the reality is the Greens do exercise significant political power in a whole variety of ways. So that's probably the key cause, is just that that demographic cohort has grown to be a much larger cohort. And so something that was not really realistic has become realistic. And ultimately, people are entitled to make their own choices. So I used to try this as an argument when I was trying to persuade people to still vote for me in spite of the fact they are unhappy with governments of Labour orientation. And it didn't work very well. The idea that at the end of the day, what you're doing is objectively going to weaken the kind of wider half of the community that broadly fits into that progressive forces frame. And if you want to do something about achieving outcomes, however difficult and messy and incoherent that usually is, if you don't have at least sort of half the population accepting your idea or supporting it or acquiescing in it, you are not going to get very far. Now, that argument didn't work very well.
Mr. Deer?
I'd just like you to comment on Julian Burnside standing for the Greens against Josh Frydenberg.
Look, I've only met Julian Burnside once or twice. I think, notwithstanding the, you know, some of the commentary about, you know, unusual club memberships and stuff like that, I think those of us on the progressive side of politics should acknowledge that he's done something pretty important and valuable things. I was heavily involved in the waterfront dispute back in the late 90s, and the fact that he was prepared to pop up and play a role in that was something that I think, you know, is important to acknowledge. What the electoral possibilities there, I don't really know. I suspect he will probably get a pretty significant vote, but where that'll head, I don't really know. But I think, you know, one of the unfortunate things is that everybody sort of immediately zeroes in on the personality characteristics and the celebrity element, good or bad, and stuff like that. It's not really the point. The point ultimately is for the voters in Kooyong, what kind of Australia do you want? And do you want Josh Frydenberg as your member, or do you want to boot him out? Would you be comfortable with electing Julian Burnside and the Greens? And that's ultimately a choice about issues and about ideas. So yes, you can get an insight into some of those things by people's past, but it's getting a bit ridiculous now in the US, where, you know, something stupid somebody did when they were 19 years old at university suddenly becomes a disqualification for high office. If that test had been applied to me, I would not have even got to the pre-selection barrier, I can tell you.
Pushing up the back end.
Thanks for your comments. George Mingle Jones talks about
the sort of differing nature of sort of the cities, the urban centres versus the rest, and talks about, you know, what we saw in Brexit and with Trump and so forth. I just wondered whether, or be keen to get your thoughts on whether you see that playing out, sort of Sydney, Melbourne versus the rest, and if that's going to be exacerbated in terms of the sort of economic and social trends going forward.
Well, I now live in country Victoria and have done. I'm a volunteer firefighter with the CFA, and my still, you know, help out in various community things as my wife has done. And although it's, you know, it's a reasonably prosperous, it's near Kyneton, it's a reasonably prosperous, as things stand at the moment, part of Victoria. Most of Victoria is pretty prosperous in aggregate at the moment. And I grew up in the country, so I got a bit of an insight into these things. I think it's a bit patchier than that, that there are parts of regional Australia doing pretty well with some good prospects, and in particular areas that are an hour or two from Melbourne and Sydney that are never likely in the foreseeable future to end up as suburbs, particularly better transport and stuff like that. They've got real strength economically and generally in good shape. There are other parts of Australia that are very economically challenged, particularly ones that have been dependent on a single industry, a single economic activity that for one reason or another is under pressure. You know, I'll be going to Cairns with Suncorp in a month or two, and that's been an area that's been significantly challenged on a variety of fronts, and it's got, you know, probably about 10% unemployment and stuff like that. But it's probably big enough to ride that through and bounce back. So I think there's a variety of circumstances, and in many respects the biggest divide is within those big cities. So yes, there's a urban-rural divide, but there's also a kind of inner city, outer city divide that in some respects is possibly the most potent of the divisions.
Mr. Tanner, I wish you well, and Thank you.
I
don't wish to embarrass you, but do you understand that the Australian Parliament, practically and intellectually, is considerably poorer since you left it?
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you to say so. The current 150 members probably won't agree with you, but look, I think and again, it's very nice, but to put that in context, I think we were fortunate for an extended period in this country where a range of forces collided to produce an era where right across the political spectrum, and I'd include people like John Howard in this, people were driven by big ideas, big arguments, big debates, and regarded political posturing as a necessary kind of associated evil. And for a whole lot of odd reasons, we have, I reckon, for about the past 15 years, drifted into a world where the political posturing has completely taken over. And it's not really fair to expect any one individual or group of individuals to somehow solve that, because politicians, just like everybody else, they're driven by the incentive structures they're surrounded by. They're like us. They say, I'm going to try and do the things I think I'll be rewarded for, and I'm going to try and avoid doing the things I think I'll be punished for. And you can't blame them for that. So it is a bit of a diabolical problem. I should also add that there are a number of people in the Parliament still who I admire greatly, and not all of them Labor people, but mostly. So I'm hoping the balance, the pendulum will swing back to a higher focus on stuff that really matters than we've seen for most of the time in recent times.
Welcome, Mr. Tanner. Just before I ask a question, you mentioned Julian Burnside. If you'd like to read about him, why don't you read Jared's Media Watchdog on Fridays? He gets quite a mention.
Yes. The only thing is I'm worried what might be said about me, though. So ignorance is bliss. Jared might be having a go at me there. He doesn't pull his punches.
Sorry, and the question is, former Prime Minister Tony Abbott recently said, if you can't vote Liberal, at least vote Labor. In other words, don't vote for an independent. What are your views on that particular aspect?
Look, broadly I agree. And I think one of the things that we lose sight of is what role the two major political forces, both in this country and most other Western countries, have played in the evolution of our societies. human beings compete and collaborate. So our great genius, as there's a great book called Sapiens by a guy called Yuval Noah Harari, which works through the very sort of primeval origins of the human species and points out that our core skill, our core secret source that's led us to dominate the planet is our capacity to collaborate in highly sophisticated ways involving literally millions of people we've never met. And so we have evolved and developed and progressed through this intricate mix of competing with each other but also collaborating. And what that's led to, of course, in modern industrial and post-industrial societies is two major political forces, one of which is broadly representing the interests of those who have a stronger interest in more collaboration because they're typically less well-off, less educated, and therefore the collective is more important to them. The other of which is broadly representing the interests of the better-off who are more likely to prosper in a more open situation. And at various times they've come to us in extreme forms, and neither of which have been particularly great. But since the sort of Second World War, the tension between those two forces and the backwards and forwards between them in a stable, established democratic society like Australia has produced pretty good societies. And so I don't like the idea of major business and senior business figures retreating from the Liberal Party, you know, because at the end of the day, having businesses at one end and trade unions at the other means that there is a stabilising force that is in both cases ultimately accountable to very large numbers of people, not directly politically, but still accountable to very large numbers of people, be it shareholders or union members. Having those the underpinnings of your major political forces has been critical to producing good societies in countries like ours. So the thing I don't like about independence, even though in some circumstances you kind of say, OK, well, I'm happy to support that person, is that they're ultimately not accountable. Because most people know very little about the people they're voting for. I got elected to Parliament six times because I had the words Australian Labor Party after my name on the ballot paper, and people therefore had some sense of consumer understanding of what they were getting when they were voting for me. Had I stood as an independent, got elected, most of them would have had no idea what I was likely to do, and I would have been free to pretty much do whatever I liked. So much as in micro it can be very deficient, the fact that you get major parties with track records and some degree of predictability about where they'll stand on issues and what they'll do is a very important thing for a stable democracy and producing stable government.
Final question. As I recall, I have your book at home. I think your first book was on the trade union movement and the clerks union and your victory over John Maynes then. Then you went on to write a couple of books on politics, and now the second of two novels. Why did you move from non-fiction to fiction, and are you likely to stay there or are you likely to go back somewhere else?
Well, the latter question depends a bit on sales. I think I managed to achieve with the first novel a sort of broadly sufficiently respectable result that my publisher was prepared to contemplate the idea of a second one. Whether or not I achieve that this time round and get invited to think about writing a third is open to question. I don't have a specific plan to do that, but in each case it's taken me 3 years of general fluffing around and lots of revisions and edits and consultations to get to that point. The answer to your substantive question, though, is I wanted to see what it was like. So I've written quite a lot of non-fiction, lots of articles, obviously, but a number of non-fiction books over the years. And I've never seen myself as a particularly literary or creative kind of person. I think I write well in the non-fiction sense, partly as a result of having had a column in the Herald Sun for a number of years in two different iterations, which taught me disciplines of short sentences and clarity and precision when you've only got 600 words and you've got to convey a message. But I just wanted to see if I could do it. And the thing that I've been really interested in is by getting things wrong and getting told in fairly blunt terms by my publisher what is wrong with what I've produced and a couple of literary editors that I've had assistance from, I've learned that there is an incredible amount of skill and craft in the fiction writing game, which sort of seems obvious, but there's amazing detail, skill and craft in it, which, as a, like no doubt most people here, a regular avid reader of fiction, has never really occurred to me. So partly it's a learning thing. I just want to sort of do it, and it's enjoyable, and it's a totally different skill from writing non-fiction. So it wasn't some kind of life plan, and it's certainly not a great way to make money, unless you're J.K. Rowling or something. So I just really did it to explore.
Well, many thanks to Lindsay Tennant. As I said, we've got copies of Come Back, and I'm sure Lindsay Tennant will be happy to sign them. Can I just say many thanks for a very thoughtful analysis? I mean, you spoke towards the end of the question-discussion period of that generation of politicians. On both sides of politics, not so long ago, we had big ideas and fought the context of ideas in a courteous way, but a very hard-headed way, which is really what good debate is all about. And tonight you've been an example of that, because you've given a very thoughtful analysis of contemporary Australian society, which, as you acknowledge, has changed quite a bit in the short period you've been out of federal politics, and probably, as you point out, will change more. But a very thoughtful analysis. I think all of us here have learned something from it. It's made us think about things, which is what we're all about here. So I'm happy with your novels. I think they're great, but I'm also happy with your non-fiction analysis, and we've got a bit of both tonight. So many thanks.
Thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.